The following program is a Nightingale Conant production for Simon & Schuster Audio.
One cause of a poor self-image, a lot of people use unfair comparisons of experiences which really have nothing to do with ability. For example, one night, for some weird reason which I'll never be able to understand, when we lived over on Dilbeck Lane in Dallas, there'd been a lot of rain. I decided that night, of all nights, I was going to put my car in the garage. I decided to come down the back alley, which was not paved. That is mistake number one. I got stuck hopelessly just outside of my own house there in the back alley. And I worked and I sweated and I burned a little rubber and so forth trying to get out of there that night. And finally I said, well, you know, nobody else is going to be foolish enough to try to come down this alley tonight. I'll just leave it here overnight. Next morning, I called the tow truck. You know, negative people call wreckers, but I needed a tow truck to get out of there. The gentleman came around and he had a very limited education. I mean, every word he said indicated that. He took a look at it, and incidentally, before I called him the next morning, I'd really been out there trying to get the car out. I'd thrown sand and bricks and boards, and I'd burned enough rubber to drive from here to Jackson, Mississippi and back, trying to get out of that hole. And finally, I gave up in frustration and called the tow truck. This old gentleman looked at it for a minute, and he said, "Let me see your keys." I said, "What you going to do with them?" He said, "I believe I can drive this car out." I said, "Man, there ain't no way. I've been working on this thing all of this time." And he said, "Well, I'd like to give it a try." Well, I'm such a gracious, kind, considerate, understanding fellow. I didn't want to embarrass the old fellow. And so I gave him my keys. And I was all prepared when he failed. I was going to be kind and gracious about it. I was going to say, "Well, you know, it was buried in there pretty deeply. Don't feel badly about it. I mean, I worked at it myself trying to get out of here." He got in the car, turned on the ignition, cranked the engine, turned the car just a tad to the left, rocked it twice, and in about 7 seconds drove it right out of there, just slickering a button. It was so easy that when he circled the block and came back, he was embarrassed about it. He wouldn't even look me in the eye, you know. And I said, "Man, how on earth did you manage to do that?" "Well," he said, "I was raised over here in East Texas." He said, "I've been driving out of gullies deeper than that since I was 12 years old." Now, that fellow was not smarter than I was. He had a different experience. See, don't ever feel inferior because somebody else has had a different experience. I would be absolutely lost back in our shipping department. I really would. Trying to ship something at the right price to the right place and have it labeled correctly, I would be lost. Don't compare experiences. A lot of times, for example, we look at a doctor in absolute awe, and that includes me. I am amazed that they can even learn those big words, much less identify them with certain parts of the body and certain ways you feel and all that kind of good stuff. But when you realize the number of years they went to school, the thousands of hours they spent in preparation, the chances are good that had you spent the same amount of time or had I spent the same amount of time, we too could be physicians. But I'll tell you what I'll bet you, $9 to a nickel again, my favorite non-bet. Let me share another story which had considerable influence in my life, and it emphasizes again why this is such an effective method of teaching. During World War II, one of my dreams was to become a naval aviator. Oh, I was real gung-ho. I was 17 on Saturday, and I signed up or started trying to sign up on Monday. I was ready to go. But now between the 11th and 12th grade, I realized that I needed more math and more science if I was going to make it into the Naval Air Corps. I was not an outstanding student. I well remember the time I brought home four F's and a C. Now, my mother was understandably upset. And she said, son, I just don't understand this. You bring home these four F's and then the C. What on earth happened? I said, well, Mom, obviously I just spent too much time concentrating on that one subject. Well, maybe it wasn't quite that bad, but I was not an outstanding student. Anyhow, I went to the summer school that summer between the 11th and 12th grade because I was so gung-ho about getting in the Air Force and I had to have more math and science. Now, one of the courses I had to take was a course in American history. In order to graduate, I had to learn it. Well, naturally, I didn't want to take any history because it obviously was going to do me no good. What possible benefit would I gain by learning about something that happened 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago? I wanted to get on with the matter at hand. I wanted to learn how I could fly that airplane so I could go shoot down the enemy and win the war. That was my goal. So I walked into the classroom that day, determined I was going to learn all I needed to know to get out of the class, and that is it. No more history for me. In reality, I walked in with a chip on my shoulder, which indicates that there's wood up above. But anyhow, I walked in. Coach Joby Harris was the teacher. And Coach Harris, for the first session, threw all of us a curve. All he did was sell. See, I happen to believe that everything is selling. And all he did was sell. He sold each one of us on why we had to learn our history. Before he got through, I was a history major. As a matter of fact, it was the only course I consistently made A's in while I was in college. Towards the end of the class, then, he shifted gears. And he started talking about America's future and where it lay. He said to us, if those of you who have an ability which goes beyond just earning a living and providing for your own needs and the needs of your family, if you've got that kind of an ability, you must devote some of your time, effort, and resources to helping those people who have less skill and less opportunity and less ability than you have. He said, as a matter of fact, if we do not reach down and start lifting these people up with better education, better direction, better opportunity, better motivation, if we don't start lifting them up, the day will come when they will reach up and by the sheer weight of numbers start pulling us down. Coach Harris was a prophet. The millions of people today on welfare, the millions of illiterates we have, the millions of people we have who have catastrophic diseases, which is draining our resources, are literally pulling us down. This generation will be the first generation in our country's history that will have a lower standard of living than the preceding one. Everything our company does, just about it, has been built around that basic concept. The concept being that you can have everything in life you want if you will just help enough other people get what they want. The work we do in prisons and schools and churches and drug rehab centers and all of these other things got their start right there. Coach Harris obviously had a dramatic impact on my life. Now, when Coach Harris was a youngster, he was a Boy Scout. He was in a troop which had a scoutmaster named Thomas B. Abernathy. Mr. Abernathy was the first scout official in the entire state of Mississippi, in addition to having his own individual scout troop. For whatever reason, Mr. Abernathy took an unusual interest in, quote, little Joby Harris. He became like a second father to him. Though Joby had a father, Mr. Abernathy spent a considerable amount of time with him, taught him not only scouting, but many other things about life. Now, Mr. Abernathy had four children. He had three daughters and a son. The youngest daughter was named Jean. Jean Abernathy has been Mrs. Zig Ziglar for over 41 years. Now, there's no way on earth that Mr. Abernathy could have known that when he was spending that extra time with little Joby Harris, that he was developing the boy and helping form his philosophy of life, and that that boy later would have such a dramatic impact on his future son-in-law's life, make him a better husband and a better father to the grandchildren, which he never had the privilege of seeing. In relationships, what I'm saying is, we never really know just how far we're going to influence not only that life or someone else's life. We need, therefore, to be very careful in our relationships. I so vividly recall that in contrast to another one of my World War II stories. They put us in the service. They put us in college in order to get us ready for going into the flight school. The first day in one of the particular classes, I was in English. The teacher there was reputed to be the toughest teacher anywhere under any circumstances. She truly was a big lady, about 6'2" tall, had shoulders like a linebacker, and she was really an imposing physical specimen. They said that she was an absolute genius on the subject of English, that she knew it better than anybody in the entire state. When she walked in, she looked at the class and she said, "Class, I'm your teacher. I want to tell you something about me so you'll know what to expect." She said, "I have been at this institution for over 25 years. And in the 25 years I have been here, there has never been but one student who made an A. I can absolutely assure you that will never happen again. That was an accident. It just slipped by. It will not take place again." "Not only that," she said, "but as I look at you, you might as well know in advance, I think it only fair to warn you, that fully one-third of you will not even pass this course." Now, I want you to get the scene. We were youngsters from all over the country gathered together at this college for the purpose of getting ready to go into the military. Most of us had had a lifetime dream of serving our country as flyers. Our entire career depended upon our passing English and all other courses. One failure and you're out. The competition was enormously tough. I heard somebody in the back say, "Boy, she is one more tough lady." And somebody else said, "Yeah, but she really knows her English." Now that I have no doubts about. She knew her English, but she didn't know her boys, and she didn't know her psychology. We were already scared to death. I just wonder how many more would have passed the class had she walked in and said, "Now, gentlemen, I might as well tell you, this is a tough class. But I might also tell you that I am a very competent instructor." And she said, "I love English and I love boys. And I just want you to know in advance that I'm going to give it my very best. I am going to teach you what I know about the English language and about the subject. We're going to dig it in depth. If for any reason any of you fail, I just want you to know in advance it is going to be your fault and not mine, because I'm committed to teaching the most effective course I've ever taught for your benefit." I believe that would have been infinitely better. You see, what I really questioned is, was she a competent English teacher? When she stands up and says, "Only one has ever made an A, one third is passed." And I wonder if she is not really saying, "I'm not really very good at teaching the subject. I know the subject, but I can't teach it." I accept full responsibility in our communications. If I do not communicate clearly to you, it is not your fault. I've always believed when somebody is speaking or teaching, if I don't understand, it's their fault. And the reason I say that, I believe anybody who understands their subject matter will be able to figure out a way to present it to me in such a manner that if I work and if I accept my responsibility of learning and paying attention and really digging into it, that if then I do not learn, I believe the teacher's got to carry the major share of the responsibility. I want you to know that I accept that responsibility. I believe and believe strongly that out of this series, you're going to get a tremendous amount of information that will make you more effective in whatever you do. And I don't care what it is, communications and relationships are still going to be involved. We're going to concentrate on our ability and the importance of looking for the good. A study was done in New York City a number of years ago on the self-made millionaires there. They selected 100 of them. And as they did their study, they discovered they had a tremendously varied background. They ranged in age from the early 20s to the late 70s. They ranged in educational background from about the fifth grade to one had two PhDs. Something like 60 or 70% of them came from towns of less than 15,000 people, for whatever that means. But the thing that they found that was absolutely consistent, that each one of them had in common, was that every one of them had the ability to see the good in other people and in other situations. So if we really start understanding that we need to be good finders and encouragers, then we've learned a very important lesson. The story is told of a businessman who went down to catch the subway. And he was in kind of a hurry. There was a beggar at the entrance to the subway selling pencils. The businessman reached in his pocket. He popped a dollar down into the tray where the pencils were and hurried to get on the subway. But after he'd gotten on the subway, he still had a minute or so before it was to leave. He got back off. He went over to the beggar selling the pencils and he reached down. He said, "You know, I owe you an apology. I was in such a hurry that I forgot. You're selling a good product, fully worth the price. You're a businessman, just like I am. I'll take my two pencils." Many months later, at a social event, the businessman encountered a well-dressed young man there who came up to him and said, "There's no way on earth you would ever recognize me." But he said, "Many months ago, I was selling pencils in the subway station, and you gave me my dignity. You did not treat me like a beggar. You treated me like a businessman. I want to say thank you." I wonder how many beggars, had they been treated like businessmen and women, would not be beggars today. Somebody said once, "It's nice to be important, but it's more important to be nice." I believe that's true. One of the most significant events of my first year in Dallas, Texas, when we moved here back in 1968, was the meeting of a man who has since come to be a very close friend of mine. His name is Walter Haley. He, at that time, was in the insurance business. He had conceived a new idea. He was selling insurance to the independent grocers around America, via selling them as they bought and dealt with the warehouse. In other words, these monstrous warehouses, when they would bill the groceries to these independent grocers all over the country, Mr. Haley gave them the idea of billing them for their insurance for all of the employees. I'm talking about life insurance as well as health and accident insurance. His average salesperson was selling $10, $15, $20 million worth of whole life insurance. That was the rage in those days. Whereas the average life insurance agent was selling in the neighborhood of about $1 million. And it took a pretty good one to sell $1 million. A friend of mine said, "I want you to meet Walter Haley. He's a most unusual man." Well, you know how some people have chemistry. You meet them and you've been friends for life. Well, Walter Haley has that charisma about him that when you meet him, you want to get to know him better. Walter is a very short man. I suspect he's about 5 feet, 5 inches tall or something along those lines. Might be a little taller. I've never really took a careful measurement of how tall he was. But when Walter Haley stuck out his hand, the first thing he said, "Zig, I've been hearing about you. Man, I am just flattered that you've come over to see me. And I can't wait to show you around and let you see what's going on." We walked into a warehouse and I was stunned. I didn't know there was that much food in the world, much less under one roof. As we walked in, he said, "Excuse me one second, Zig." He walked over to the switchboard operator and he said, "I'm Walter Haley." And he said, "I just want to tell you that I think you're doing an absolutely magnificent job on this switchboard." You know, he said, "I never dial this number that I don't get the distinct impression that all you're doing is sitting there waiting for me to call so you can put me through to the proper person." He said, "You just do a beautiful job." She said, "Well, thank you, Mr. Haley. I really appreciate that." He said, "Well, I appreciate you." We left and we were walking down one of the corridors and he said, "Excuse me a second, Zig." He stepped in the office and he stuck his hand out. He said, "I haven't met you. I'm Walter Haley. I haven't had the privilege of even seeing you before, but I've been reading the reports and watching what's happening since you took over." And he said, "Man, you're just doing an absolutely magnificent job, and I want to thank you for it." The man smiled, of course, very broadly and said, "Well, Mr. Haley, I do the best I can." And Walter Haley said, "That's good enough for me. You just keep it up. You're really doing a marvelous job." We left there. We walked upstairs. And we walked into Walter's office, and the first person we saw was his secretary. And he said, "Zig, shake hands with the greatest secretary who ever sat behind a desk." And he said to her, "You know, my wife thinks you hung the moon. And she thinks you can take it down just whenever you want to. And I'm going to ask you to please leave it up there. I love to see it as I'm riding, especially on my way down south at night." "Oh, Mr. Haley," she said, "you're always saying something like that. And your wife is really a sweet lady. But I just want you to know, keep it up. I really like to hear it." We walked into his office and there sat an insurance rep. And Walter Haley said, "Zig, shake hands with one of the greatest life insurance men to ever put on a pair of shoes." He said, "Oh, Walter, you're always saying things like that." But he said, "I love it. I love it." Now, the entire trip took less than 10 minutes. How many of you, though, believe that as a result of that 10 minutes, those four people had a marvelous day? Absolutely. He had built them up. Now, I want to stress something very important, because this is the key to the whole thing. If you're sincere, it's enormously effective. If you're insincere, it's manipulative. Now, you see, when you're manipulative, the manipulator will say and do things so that he or she can win. Today, Walter Haley is, quote, retired, about as retired or unretired as anybody on the face of this earth. He's busier than ever. He's a multi-millionaire, has friends everywhere he goes. He's what we call a happy miser. He saves every friend he makes. He believes you can never get ahead by trying to get even. I think he's right. The motivator understands that it's a win-win situation. You're not doing it for your benefit. You do it for their benefit. But when they benefit, you benefit. And we go right back to the whole concept that you can have everything in life you want if you will just help enough other people get what they want. If that brilliant physician were given your job right now, he would be totally incapable of handling it until he had acquired the experience which you have of handling it. It is fine to admire other people and other professionals. I do. I know you do too. It's fine to admire them, but that's got nothing to do with your position on the totem pole. You're good at what you do, and you can get better at what you do. There are roughly 1 billion Chinese on the face of this earth, and all of them, a year old and older, can do something that I can't do, and I'll bet you can't either. They can speak Chinese. Now, does that mean they're smarter than we are, or does it just mean that they've had a different experience? There are about 7 million Australians that can do something that would scare me to death. They can drive down the wrong side of the highway. Now, does that mean they're smarter than we are? No, it just means they've had a different experience. What I'm saying out of all of this, you need to concentrate on the positive and not the negative. Don't feel inferior because somebody else can do something better than you can do. I was listing the things the other day that I cannot do. I cannot really fill out my own tax form. I couldn't take out my own tonsils. I can't repair my own teeth. I know nothing about repairing an automobile. As a matter of fact, I had a mechanical bypass when I was very young. I cannot fix anything of an electrical nature. There are thousands of things I cannot do. Now, that doesn't bother me, and I hope it doesn't bother you. The other people can do those things. I know how to talk, and I know how to write, and those are the things which I concentrate on. What am I saying? I'm saying, find your strength and develop those strengths. Since we cannot be champions at everything, many people have a natural tendency to play down the talents or qualities in which we do excel. In the process, we occasionally end up with phony humility. We shouldn't think in terms of being better or worse than anyone else. As individuals, we are unique and different from anybody else. There have been 11 billion people to walk this earth, approximately. There's never been two who were exactly alike. I can honestly say to you that you truly are unique. You very definitely are different. And we need to understand that. It will help our self-image. What can be a factor in poor self-images? Well, race can be a factor. In our society particularly. I never realized the seriousness of this until I was watching, I guess it was about 20 years ago, a movie or a presentation on television with Bill Cosby. It was sponsored by the Xerox Corporation. Now, when I was a child, Shirley Temple was one of my favorites. I used to get the biggest charge out of watching her, you know, singing her little songs and on the good ship Lollipop. I thought it was the cutest thing I ever saw in my life. I really did. But Bill Cosby let me look at it through the black man's eyes. And I saw it altogether differently. Let me play the scene for you. It's a birthday party. Shirley Temple is about 5 or 6 years old. The scene opens and she is bidding her little friends goodbye, thanking them. You know, she's a very personable little girl. And then a black girl who appeared to be about 14 years old, and two or three of her friends came up as the party was ending, and the older girl had a little present in her. She said, Miss Shirley, we brought you a present. And what did Miss Shirley do? She said, oh, thank you very much. And we have some leftover birthday cake. Why don't you come and have some? Another girl said, oh, Miss Shirley, I'll tell you, when you get that picture, it's easy to understand the tremendous negative impact when a black child would watch that and see what was being stereotyped there. That day was an eye-opener for me. I learned to see my black brothers and sisters in an entirely different way. The way you treat people, you see, can have a dramatic impact on the image that individual has. Race can definitely be a factor. I was so delighted to see Doug Williams do well in the Super Bowl. But isn't it tragic that so much was made out of it? And the reason I say that so much was made out of it, it should have been hardly mentioned. It should have been simply, well, what do you expect? Here's a superb athlete, a magnificent football player, had a great team behind him. The fact that he was black indicates, ladies and gentlemen, that we've still got a long way to go in this area. And I hope we will all work on it more and more. What's the cause of a poor self-image? Og Mandino, in his book, The Greatest Miracle in the World, said that a couple of things came along. A fellow named Darwin, who said we were, you know, created from lower life. And another fellow named Freud, who said that our thoughts and actions originated from early childhood experiences. They're deeply buried in our subconscious mind, which we could neither control nor understand, and for which, therefore, we are not responsible. With one scientist saying we came from animals, and the other saying there's nothing we can do about ourselves, no wonder some people have poor self-images. For what it's worth, Darwin, before his death, recognized God as the architect of the universe and contributed much money to Christian missionaries before his death. An article in Psychology Today revealed that of all of the concepts that Freud brought forth, there has not been a single one of them, not one, which has been scientifically validated. John Hopkins psychologist Robert Hogan said this, "Freud thought you could study neuronics and learn about normals. He got it backward. You have to study the normal to understand the delinquent." And I believe, of course, he is 100% right. What are some other causes of a poor self-image? Pornography is one of the causes of poor self-image. Now, why would that be? It is simply because, number one, it is particularly demeaning to women. Number two, pornography pictures mankind as being almost entirely animalistic. It leaves out all of the tender, understanding, loving compassion. Some psychologists have said that when you watch one pornographic movie three times, like a Deep Throat, for example, that it has the same impact as one actual experience along those lines. Soap operas and the horoscope are a couple of things that are not good for the self-image. I challenge anybody on the soap opera with this statement. I believe it is impossible to watch them every day and remain optimistic and morally sound. I don't believe you can do it. I challenge you to do this. Take your Saturday's newspaper, if you really want to have some family fun, take your Saturday's newspaper, clip out the weekly summation of the soap operas, cut them up, giving each family member, two of them, challenge them to stand up and read with a straight face what has happened to those people all week long. You cannot do it. But when you view them, you know, with the music and the drama there, they are very, very addictive. They really are. Horoscope? Well, let me tell you the problem with horoscopes. Basically, when the redhead and I were in England touring there about 4 years ago, we went to the castle of Henry VIII. We saw the magnificent castle where he was. We saw the famous clock that he had created, and we saw the picture that they believed was true in those days, that the sun revolved around the earth. It is upon that theory that the horoscope is written. Now, if that's science, I did have monkeys as ancestors. Now, the thing that is the difficulty, the thing that creates the problem, is this. The horoscope will make you fatalistic. When you start reading it every day, and how many times have I had people say, "Oh, I just look at it, don't pay any attention at all to it." Then why read it if you don't pay any attention at all? It can become addictive, and it can influence your behavior. The greatest single cause of a poor self-image is the absence of unconditional love. The beautiful thing is we can do something about that. Love is one of those things which is so powerful and so important. I was in Melbourne, Australia last summer as part of our tour. We'd been to Japan to look at their factories and their schools and to see what they were doing. We went on to other areas of the country. We went into Hong Kong to do what we could about the local economy. We went from there on down to Malaysia. And in Malaysia, we had a speaking engagement. Then we went on down to New Zealand, had a couple of engagements there, and then to Australia. Ended up in Melbourne. At one of the sessions, a lady came up to me and she said, "Mr. Ziegler, I'm 32 years old. I've got your tapes. On one of the tapes, you keep saying, 'Tell your children that you love them. Tell them that you love them.'" She said, "In my 32 years of life, nobody has ever told me they loved me. I've never said to my little girls, 8 and 10 years old, that I love them. But I kept playing that tape, and you kept telling me, 'Tell them you love them. Tell them you love them.'" You even said that if you don't tell them, when they grow up and get married, that they will never tell your grandchildren that they're loved. Somebody has got to break the chain. One day she said, I blurted it out that I loved them. They were in considerable shock for a moment. And then they both just grabbed me and started hugging. And from there on in, it was much easier. And Mr. Ziegler, she said, you cannot believe the psychological problems that my two little girls had. They were terrible, awful, including a reversion to infantile behavior. But within 60 days after I started telling them that I loved them, 98% of those psychological problems were solved. The ancient prophet said it well when he said that love never fails. I'm just absolutely convinced that it will overcome an awful lot of mistakes. Now, please understand, the last thing I ever want to do is hang a guilt trip on anybody. The past is behind us. And if we go back and say, oh, if I'd done this, things would have been different, then I have failed in this recording. We want to look to the future. We did, I'm convinced as a parent, though I made many mistakes, we did in my family the best we could with the information we had under the circumstances that existed at that time. And I'm confident that you did exactly the same thing. Let's forget the past, except using the experience as a learning experience. Let's take new information, a new look at the future. Use what we have. We can do something about the future. There's nothing we can do about the past. Poor self-image manifests itself in the way we handle our personal lives. You tell a youngster with a poor self-image that he ought to stay away from drugs, they'll kill you. And his response, at least internally, many times is, don't tell me that. My friends tell me that they make you feel good, make you feel big. Besides, suppose they're not good for me. What difference does it make? I'm a nothing. I'm a nobody. Got nothing to lose. A person with a good self-image would not respond in any such manner. You tell a youngster, study for his lessons and obey the law. If he's got a poor self-image, many times they're so negative, they say, it won't do me any good. You know, the deck's artist act. I came on the wrong side of the tracks. The rich kids are going to get all of their breaks. Why shouldn't I have a little fun right now? You'd say to a youngster with a poor self-image, you really ought to save yourself for marriage. And their instant thinking is, who's going to marry me? What chance have I got? Why not I have a little fun now? That's what it's all about. My peer group tells me I've got to do these things to be accepted. Since I have nothing to lose, why not go ahead? An individual with a poor self-image is jealous without cause. Now, I'm not talking about jealousy for cause. Ladies, if he comes in smelling like joy and lipstick all over his collar, jealousy is not a manifestation of a poor self-image. That has nothing to do with it. But some people say, you know, oh, I just love him so much, I can't let him out of my sight. Or I just love her so much, I don't want her out of my sight. What they're really saying is, I don't understand why this person married me in the first place. I certainly do not deserve him or her. A jealous, critical nature is one of the manifestations of a poor self-image. They can't handle constructive criticism, much less criticism itself. One of the interesting manifestations of a poor self-image is old motor mouth. We once had one who worked for us. Now, there's a guy that if you ask him what time it was, he would tell you how to build a clock. I mean, literally, you have seen people who are like that. You know, they corner you, or they come visiting you, and they start talking, and they talk, and they talk. I mean, incessantly they talk. And finally, you persuade them that it's time for them to leave, or else they give you some indications that they're going to leave. And they get to the front door, and they open the door, and they talk another 5 minutes there in the door. And if you happen to have visited their house, and you're trying to leave, they follow you all the way out to the car. And as you're backing out, they're signaling you to roll down the window. They got one more thing they want to tell you. I see some of you know exactly what I'm talking about. The class clown is a typical example of an individual with a poor self-image. They come in a couple of minutes late, you know, and distract everything. Oh, have you already started the class, Miss Brown? Oh, did we have any assignment today? They're people who feel they cannot attract any attention on their own. Therefore, they got to make a show of that nature. Now, on the other end of the scales, on occasion, the quiet ones also have a poor self-image. They don't think they've got anything at all to offer. They read somewhere that still water runs deep, and that it is better to remain silent and let people think you're not smart than it is to speak up and let everybody know that you're not smart. So they, a lot of times, the very quiet ones. But let me stress that in the case of the class cut-up, the motor mouth, or the quiet ones, the key word is that could be the manifestation of a poor self-image. Not always. If a person exhibits any of these three characteristics, he does not necessarily have a poor self-image, but the odds are pretty good that he does. I mention this because if any of these characteristics describe you, the identification process will encourage you to take the necessary steps so that you can do something about it. If they describe any of your friends, associates, or relatives, it will enable you to recognize them and be able to be of assistance to them. One of the manifestations of a poor self-image is a lack of commitment. People don't set goals. You see, they figure this. If I make a commitment, if I set a goal, if I say that I'm going to do this, and then it doesn't work out, then what that does is it further destroys my self-image. Therefore, if I don't make the commitment, then there's no way I can fail at the project. Negative people, as I said earlier, seldom are very persistent because they simply do not believe they can accomplish any objectives. Poor self-image is manifested a lot of times, particularly in the way we treat people in a subservient position. One of the things that bothers me the most is when I see someone abuse another individual who cannot defend themselves. For example, a waiter or waitress, in many cases, cannot properly defend themselves. Somebody who is in a position of a shipping clerk or a file clerk or somebody, you know, who really is at an entrance level position, they cannot properly defend themselves. I think the most irritated I've ever been with anybody is one day an associate of mine abused my secretary, not the one I have now. This was years before that. That was most unfair and completely uncalled for. If he wants to fight, he should fight with me. I can fight back. But she was not in position to fight back. A person who will do that, you can just put your last penny on it. There's an individual who really has a distorted sense of values and who also does have a poor self-image. A lot of times, a new employee with a poor self-image will come in and make some unrealistic promises about what they can do. The new coach sometimes does exactly the same thing. A lot of kids with poor self-images always insist on picking up the tab for the Cokes. Buddies get together, you know. They don't deserve to be friends with anybody on their own merit, but if I pick up the tab for the Cokes, then, you know, I'm a good guy, and they'll accept me as part of the group, and I'll be invited back in. It used to bother me before I got into this years and years ago when I was in sales management. I would watch salespeople who I knew were broke. If it hadn't cost but 50 cents to go around the world, they couldn't have gotten out of sight. And yet I have seen some of them absolutely insist on picking up the tab every time the group went out anywhere. They did not feel that they could be accepted on their own. Self-image is so important. I want to read something here that is so important that I didn't want to take a chance on just verbalizing it and not communicating exactly what I wanted to say. The person with a poor self-image doesn't move successfully into management. He fears rejection by the people over him, under him, or around him. He often steps out of character and dons one of four ill-fitting masks. He tries to be good old Joe. and assures his subordinates that nothing has changed. He desperately tries to be one of the gang. Second, in his fear of rejection by his former peers, he makes concessions and exceptions that go beyond the principles of good management. Sometimes he does the opposite and takes an arrogant, "I have arrived" approach, which causes resentment among his former peers. Third, he may be unduly concerned about his relationship with management. And in his anxiety to please, he becomes too servile, eats too much humble pie, and seeks too much advice. He has an exaggerated fear of failure because he sees his worth in terms of never failing. Ironically, this fear of failure causes him to hesitate too long before taking any action. This unrealistic hesitancy is often the cause of failure. Fourth, the manager with a poor self-image may assume a know-it-all attitude, seek advice from no one, and set out to show everyone that he knows how to run the ship. A poor self-image is manifested in every walk of life. Even good old Joe, or Josie, have the problem, which is a common one and is no respecter of age, sex, education, size, or skin color. He has the "I must be a nice guy and never offend anyone" kind of a self-image syndrome. And listen, as a youngster, he smokes cigarettes he doesn't want, takes a drink he doesn't like, laughs at dirty jokes that actually offend him, joins the gang he secretly dislikes, and goes along with illegal or immoral conduct, and participates in a dress code he secretly abhors. All because he has never accepted himself and is terribly concerned that if he asserts himself and crosses his peer group, he will not have any friends. As an adult, he has a tendency to tell people only what he thinks they want to hear. He would never send an overcooked steak back to the kitchen. He even gives up his place in the barbershop, lets others take his parking spot, or even crash the line in front of him. He doesn't argue with the boss nor object when a coworker takes credit for work he has done. Now, don't misunderstand. If you are Joe, and your self-image is so healthy, you can conduct yourself in this manner because this is what you want, that's okay. If you view these incidents as minor or small stuff that mean nothing in your game plan for life, then your self-image is in excellent shape. However, if you do these things to gain acceptance, you're gaining everything but acceptance. The reason is simple. You're not presenting the real you. In fact, you're presenting a phony, and most people, including other phonies, don't like a phony. It was a proud moment, a very proud moment. The new citizens of the United States were at the ceremony. They were going to be inducted, they were going to become official citizens of the United States. And the man in charge was and he said to them, "Now, we have some questions we want to ask of you. The first question is, identify the source of this quote. I regret that I have but one life to give for my country." Silence. Nothing. He looked around. Then a little Japanese boy popped up and he said, "Nathan Hale, 1776. And the man in charge said, "That's absolutely right." He said, "All right, I have a second question. This one took place in Virginia. A young man spoke up and he said in front of the Virginia House of Commons, 'I don't know what course you may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.'" Young Japanese boy popped up again and he said, "Patrick Henry, 1775. Little voice from the rear muttered, "Darn Jap." The man in charge looked somewhat startled. He said, "Who said that?" The voice came back, "Lee Iacocca, 1985. Relationships are enormously important. They affect all ages, all colors, all beliefs, all creeds. We have to deal with both the male and the female. Our relationships are enormously important. I just love what George Washington Carver had to say. This gentle, humble botanist once advised, "How far you go in life depends on your being tender with the young, impassionate with the aged, sympathetic with the striving, and tolerant of the weak and the strong. Because someday in life you will have been all of these." That is so true. Carver was one of the most unique men in the history of our country. He was a man who is forever recognized as being the founder of Tuskegee University. Carver said one day he was in prayer and he was saying, "God, I want to serve you. I want to do what you want me to do. I would like for you to reveal to me the mysteries of the universe." And according to Carver, at that precise moment, a peanut fell at his feet. And the Lord spoke to him and he said, "George, the peanut is more your size." He said it was a very interesting experience. But he decided to settle for the peanut instead of the universe. And he discovered 300 different uses of the peanut and 118 uses for the sweet potato. You see, when you look at something like that, you can see tremendous opportunity even in a peanut. What we're going to be doing today is looking at the tremendous opportunity inside the human being. There's more misery, more frustration, anxiety, and grief because of improper relationships than any other single factor. We have more joy, however, more happiness, more excitement because of proper relationship than of any other factor. So relationships, obviously, because they start at the beginning of life and continue to the end of life, and because they involve us all of our life in between and determine our effectiveness with our family, with our friends, with our associates, with everybody else, relationships then are extraordinarily important, and having the proper attitude in those relationships are extremely important. I believe this next little story sums it up quite well. The story goes that a man was being given a chance to look at both heaven and hell so he could make a decision as to which place he really wanted to go. So they took him into the halls of hell, first of all. And as he walked in, he thought to himself, "Boy, now if this is hell, this is for me." Because there were a large number of people seated at a real long banquet table. And on the banquet table, they had every kind of food that you could possibly imagine. They had all of the vegetables, all of the salads, all of the meats, all of the entrees, all of the desserts. They had every exotic food that's available in this world today. But as the man looked at the people who were there, he noticed that even though there was a feast in front of them, they appeared to be starved. As a matter of fact, there was no laughter, there was no gaiety, nobody was having any fun at all. And yet right in front of them was a feast that anybody would have loved to have had. And then they took him over into heaven. And over there he walked in and he saw identically the same menu. Had the long banquet hall in front of him. The long banquet table was there. Had these magnificently attractive foods, exactly the same menu as had been there over in hell. But he noticed these people were all laughing and singing and having a marvelous time. They were well fed. They were healthy. And the visitor who was taking the tour turned to his guide and says, "Well, I'm a little puzzled." He says, "As a matter of fact, I'm very puzzled. I could not help but notice that they had the same menu, the same food in the other place, but over there they were starving. Over here, in reality, they're having a wonderful time. They're well fed. They're healthy. What on earth is the difference?" And the tour guide said, "Well, had you looked very carefully, you would have noticed that in both places, there is a knife and a fork strapped to the arms of each one of the inhabitants. And the knife and the fork are both 4 feet long. And over in hell, what they're trying to do is they're trying to feed themselves. But they cannot. But in heaven, you see, they are feeding the person directly in front of them who in turn is feeding them. That pretty well sums up the gist of what I'll be talking about. Because you see, it is true that you can have everything in life you want if you will just help enough other people get what they want. As we look at relationships, let's very quickly review what everyone wants in life. Everyone wants to be happy. Everyone wants to be healthy. Everyone wants to be at least reasonably prosperous. Everyone wants to have friends. Everyone wants to have peace of mind. Everyone wants to be secure. Now, for those who have families, they obviously want to have good family relationships. Now, as we look at the six basics that everybody wants, let's look at the role that relationships play. All of the authorities will tell you that your health, to a very large degree, depends on how well you get along with other people. Everybody will agree that how happy you are depends to a very large degree on your relationship with other people. Many will tell you that your amount of prosperity is determined by a large degree as to how well you get along with others. Ohio State University, as a simple example, did a study of the 50 reasons that people lose their jobs. And they had to get to reason number 16 before it had anything to do with their technical expertise or their job skills. Their first 15 dealt with attitudes and their ability to cooperate with, get along with other people. Your relationship certainly will determine the number and quality of friends that you have. Your relationships will determine to a large degree just how much satisfaction and peace of mind you have. Your relationship will determine just how secure you are, because the most insecure feeling in the world is to know that you have no one who really loves and cares for you. And the most secure feeling, every time I see anyone who is ill, the first thing they talk about is whether they are alone or whether their friends and family have been supportive of them. And of course, the key to good family relationships is the way you get along with those people. Now, this session is going to involve lots of stories, parables, examples, analogies, and quotations. As always, I'll identify the source of my information when it's possible. Now, I do always identify the source for three basic reasons. Number one, it is the right thing to do. Number two, it indicates to a degree that I've done my research. And number three, in the event it is wrong, I can always say, you know, that fellow ought to know better than that. Or I can't believe that lady didn't know any better than that. Now, in the book of Mark, we read, and I quote verbatim from one of the Bibles, "By parable taught he them, and without a parable taught he not them." He's talking about Christ's relationship with his disciples. So we're going to be using a lot of parables and a lot of stories. Also, psychologist Renee Fuller has discovered that storytelling is the key to learning. You see, people remember stories. And if the story has a real moral to it, a real lesson in it, then we will remember the lesson. As a sales trainer, for example, I do a one-hour session on one single sales story that I spent no more than 20 minutes in the entire transaction, and yet there are 25 specific lessons that I extract from that one story that took place from a sales training, sales presentation point of view. And people remember it simply because they can identify with the story. Just for a moment, let's play a little game. It's early in the morning. Your telephone rings. The voice at the other end says, "Hey, partner, I've been meaning to call you for a long time. You know, I think you're one of the nicest guys I've ever seen in my life. You're a real asset to the community. You're a credit to the profession of which you're a part. What a delight it is to be able to call you friend. You know, I wish that you and I could spend more time together, because every time I'm with you or around you, I'm so much more enthusiastic. I do so much better. You know, if I could spend 20 minutes a day with you, my life would be wonderfully rich, and I could just do so much more. And I know I should have called you and told you this years ago, but I, for whatever reason, didn't do it, and I just wanted to do it now. I look forward to the next time I can see you and we can spend some time together. See you later." And he hangs up. Now, let me ask you a question. If you had ever gotten such a telephone call as that, or if you should get such a phone call as that, and it was from an old and trusted friend, and you knew he was deadly serious, let me ask you, what kind of day would you have? Magnificent, wouldn't it? If you were a doctor, would you be a better doctor? If you were a household executive, would you be a better household executive? If you were on a sales call, would you make a better, more effective sales call? Would you be a better mother? Would you be a better truck driver? Would you be a better student? Would you be better at whatever it is that you're doing? How many of you believe you would be better at whatever you do? Now, how much more would you know about being a doctor or a truck driver or a household executive or a salesperson? You wouldn't know any more. But you would be substantially better because all of a sudden your image has changed. Your attitude has changed. Why? I'm an asset to my community. I'm a credit to my profession. That old boy said so, and he is one more smart cookie. I mean, you wouldn't argue with that at all, would you? The truth is you would feel better, do better, and be better because you would think a little more of yourself. Now, since that would make you feel so much better, let me ask you a question. Why don't you make a phone call like that on a regular basis to someone whom you know and respect and admire that you could honestly say something nice about? I have a good friend who is also a speaker, a very prominent one. He heard me go through this little routine one day and he said, you know, I think I'm going to give that a shot. The following Saturday night, he got on the phone long distance and called a friend of his whom he had not seen in a few weeks. And when he started the conversation similar to that, maybe not quite that flowery, but saying something really nice, the old boy at the other end was so shocked and so excited and so enthused that they spent about 30 minutes talking. My friend said that when he put that telephone down, he was just hiring a kite. And so consequently, every Saturday night, he does that. See, you can have everything in life you want if you'll just help enough other people get what they want. How do you treat people? Well, this might shock you a little bit, but I believe y'all treat people like cows. Now, I don't know how much thought you have given this, but when I was a boy down in Yazoo City, Mississippi, and I know that a lot of people go around the country trying to impress people by claiming to be from Yazoo City, but I really am. It's an exciting place. About once a month, a train comes through town. Which doesn't sound like excitement until I explain we don't have any tracks there. And then that changes the picture of it. So, you see, I can tease about that town for a very, very good reason. When I was a child there, we survived because we had 5 milk cows and a large garden. My mother taught me many, many lessons. My dad had died early in life. And I can tell you something about cows. Now, you tell me, what are her chances in life? I think you'd agree they were very, very slim indeed. But Linda Isaac's mother was getting on up in years. She brought Linda to Dallas to live with an older sister. The older sister took her over to Goodwill Industries, where she met a lady named Carol Clapp. Now, Carol Clapp took one look at Linda Isaacs, and she did not see a helpless, hopeless little girl who would be a ward of the state all of her life. She saw a little girl who was obviously put here for a purpose. There was a reason for her being here, and she determined she was going to find out what that reason was. They gave her some more evaluations. They discovered that Linda Isaacs could learn some things. They gave her a simple little job, which she outgrew that afternoon. The next day, they gave her 2 more jobs, which she quickly outgrew. Now, go forward with me 12 months. And 12 months later, Linda Isaacs is answering the telephone, checking the payroll, and functioning almost as a full-fledged secretary. She learned more in 12 months than she had in 18 years. For 18 years, Linda Isaacs had been repeatedly told, Linda can't learn, Linda can't learn, Linda can't learn. And for 18 years, Linda Isaacs had been repeating it back, Linda can't learn, Linda can't learn, Linda can't learn. And it's absolutely true that as ye sow, so also shall ye reap. The computer people are right. Garbage in, garbage out. We're right when we say you put the good stuff in, you get the good stuff out. All of a sudden, the input changes. Somebody says, Linda can learn, Linda can learn, Linda can learn. And Linda Isaacs, in wild-eyed astonishment, then started saying, Linda can learn. Now, please don't misunderstand. I'm not saying that all you got to do is say, I can. But I am saying this. I cannot help but wonder how many people have been consigned to a life of mediocrity because they were repeatedly told, you can't, you can't, you can't. Shad Helmstetter, in his book, What to Say When You Talk to Yourself, says the average 18-year-old American has been told 148,000 times, no, or you can't do it. Now, you tell a youngster 148,000 times they can't do something, I can guarantee you they'll believe it. The greatest good we can do for others is not just to share our riches with them, but to reveal theirs to them. Others express it this way. You give a man a fish, you feed him for the day. You teach him to fish, you feed him for life. Again, don't misunderstand. I'm not saying that all you got to do is say, you can do it, and they will be able to do it. The question often comes up, or I might emphasize over on top of that by saying, they've got an infinitely better chance of doing it if you tell them they can instead of telling them they can't. In order to be fair, I believe we should give them the benefit of the doubt. Now, a lot of times people have either thought it or they've said it to me, now, wait a minute, Ziegler. Suppose my child does a lousy job. Suppose they drop the ball. Suppose they foul up. Suppose my employees don't do the job they're supposed to. Are you still supposed to brag on them? I think that's the worst thing you could possibly do. That encourages mediocrity. A minority race in San Francisco brought suit against the school system because all the time they were in it, they were told over and over, you're doing good, you're doing good, you're doing good. And then when they got out of school, the reality is they could not get a job because they had not gotten an education. I believe that my mother has the correct answer. When I was a child down in Yazoo City, Mississippi, since Dad had died, we all had to go to work pretty early. By the time I was 8 years old, I was milking a cow and working in the garden. Now, I don't know what all of you know about cows. Some of you might be city slickers sitting here today. And I know a lot of you who listen to the recordings will be city slickers. So let me just tell you one little thing about cows. Cows don't give milk. I'm here to tell you, you got to fight for every drop of it. I'll never forget that first solo assignment I had in the garden. Now, there's some things we knew about our mother. We knew what she expected when she gave us an assignment. That was our very best. We also knew that she was going to inspect to make certain she got what she expected. We also knew that she was going to teach us how to do what she expected us to do. One of the most frustrating things parents and managers can do to their child or their employees is to tell them to do something and them not know how to do that particular thing or why it is to be done, and they don't give them any of the reasons for doing it, and they don't give them the ways to do it. Mother always taught us how, and she told us why. And then if we did a good job, she would always compliment on it. But she always inspected to make certain she got what she had expected. Well, this first solo assignment, I had to hoe 2 rows of beans, and they were 3.5 miles long. Would you believe 3 miles long? But when you're 8 years old, it looked like they were 3.5 miles long. Mother showed me exactly what she wanted me to do. And then she said, son, when you get through, call me. Well, I finally finished. I called my mama. I said, Mama, I'm through. Well, my mama was a little bitty lady, only about 5 feet tall, weighed less than 100 pounds. She was slightly stooped at that time. She always wore a little cloth sunbonnet on her head to protect her face from that hot Mississippi sun. And when Mama was dissatisfied with something we had done, she would always fold her hands behind her back. She would always duck her head. She would always cock it slightly to the right, and she'd always give it that little left to right motion that said, uh-uh. My mama started that left to right. I said, what's the matter, Mama? My mama smiled a little bit, and she said, well, son, it looks like you're going to have to lick this calf over. Now, is there anybody who does not understand that perfectly good immensely clear, old colloquial Mississippi term, lick the calf over. Well, what that means in a nutshell is, son, this is unsatisfactory. You're going to have to do the job over. Well, I knew perfectly good and well what my mama was telling me. But I was just trying to buy time. And so I looked at her, I kind of grinned. I said, Mama, I haven't been messing with the calf. I've been hoeing these beans. Mama kind of laughed. She said, well, son, what I mean is this. For most boys, what you've done would have been perfectly all right. But you're not most boys. You're my son. And my son can do better than this. You see, she'd criticized the performance. It needed criticizing. But she had praised the performer because he needed the praise. I left with my self-image completely intact. I believe that's the procedure in building winning relationships with other people. When we do have to deal with a productivity factor that is unsatisfactory, a performance that is not up to standards, I believe we need to remember that we do not chastise or criticize the individual, but we deal rather with the performance of that individual. I believe that's the way to build more winning relationships. Help that person to be more productive. Help that individual to have a higher self-esteem and overall be best for everyone concerned. I close with this. Many years ago in Europe, an old man sat at a cathedral playing. He was a skilled musician. The old cathedral was absolutely beautiful. And as the sun was setting, and you could see the sun coming through those stained glass windows, watching the old musician playing, he took on an absolutely angelic appearance. He filled that church with that beautiful, beautiful music. But it was sad and melancholy because today was his last day. He was being replaced by a younger organist. At dusk, the back door of the cathedral opened rather brusquely, and a young man stepped inside. The old organist looked at him and recognized who he was. He reached up and removed the key, put it in his pocket, and headed for the back door. When he drew abreast of the young man just held out his hands and with a few simple words said, "Please, the key." The old man put the key in the hand of the young organist. The young organist almost literally ran to the organ. And he looked at the bench and he looked at the organ for just a moment. Then he sat down, inserted the key, turned it on, and started to play. While the old man had played beautifully and skillfully, the young man played with sheer genius. Music filled the cathedral. It filled the town. It filled the countryside. Music such as they had never heard around there. This was the world's introduction to the music of Johann Sebastian Bach. With tears streaming down his cheeks, the old man said, "Suppose, just suppose, I had not given the master the key." I believe inside of every human being, that's you included, there is incredible ability and talent. And I believe the best way to get our own talent out is to start looking for the talent in others. Encourage them, because it is absolutely true. You can have everything in life you want if you will just help enough other people get what they want. I've often wondered what it would be like if I had the privilege of spending time with everyone who's ever read one of my books, sat in one of my audiences, seen one of my videos, or heard one of the audio recordings. I wonder what it would be like. I wish I could, but that doesn't seem to be possible. Today I'm in Dallas. Tomorrow again I'll be speaking in Dallas. The next day I'll be speaking in St. Louis. The next day I'll be back here. And the story goes on, and I never really get to know the people whom I deal with. If you and I had some time together, what a privilege it would be for me to spend that time with you, looking you right in the eye, and here's what I'd say. I would say to you that you were designed for accomplishment. You're engineered for success. You're endowed with the seeds of greatness. I would remind you that since the beginning of time, there have been over 11 billion people to walk the face of this earth. But there never has been, and there never will be, another one just like you. You're rare. You're unique. You're different. I challenge you just to look around this room at the other men and women here. You're dramatically different. No two of you are even close to being alike. If I had the privilege, I'd look you right in the eye and say that God loves you. He wants the best for you. He loves you so much, He created you in His own image. That makes you special. I don't know how many of you follow the political arena. I'm fascinated by it and always have been. When the next election comes up, I so badly hope that you're registered to vote. And then I hope you're registered in the next one and the next one and the next one, because if you don't take part in the political process, then you surrender all griping rights. You have no right to complain about anything that goes on here because you're not participating in the process. I hope you'll vote in future elections. But I'm going to urge you at this moment to participate in the most important election you will ever vote in. I'm going to ask you at this moment to step back into the polling booth of your own mind. And because this election is so enormously important, I'm going to suggest that you close the draperies so no one else can see your innermost thoughts and exactly how you're going to vote. And as you step into this polling booth, if you will turn around, you will notice there's a series of levers up there for the people you to vote for. One of them stands out because the name is emblazoned in pure gold. That name is your very own. I'm going to ask you to reach up, grab that lever vigorously and forcefully, pull it down, vote for you. And when you do, you will see that long ago, God had already voted for you. With those two votes, you can win any election or any contest you will ever enter as long as you shall live. That eternal arithmetic clearly says you plus God equals enough. Enough.
This has been a Nightingale Conant production for Simon & Schuster Audio.
I can tell you that if you walk in a cold barn on a cold winter morning, an old cow's laying there, and you reach over and give her a big kick and say, "Get up from there. No wonder your milk production is down and your butter fat is well. You're just laying around. Did you hear what I said? Get up from there. We're going to have to do a better job of producing." Now, if you treat that old cow like that, let me tell you, first of all, she just might kick you back. Second, I can emphatically tell you that the milk she produces, number one, will be less in amount, and it will be unfit for human consumption. You will get her so upset, now this is a fact, so upset that the milk will be too bitter for you to drink. Now, I don't necessarily think you've got to walk in the barn there and hug the old cow and say, "Good morning, old cow." Though it's not going to hurt you to at least give her a little hug. You can look at her and say, "My goodness, you got the best looking pair of double legs I think I have seen today. And the skin, it is so nice and soft there. And I just want to tell you, old cow, how proud I am of you. You know, your production is way up and your butter fat is rising steadily. And I have an idea that today you're going to make your best effort ever to break all of your records. I just really appreciate you, old cow." Now you might say, Ziegler, that's pretty far-fetched. Let me tell you a true story. Back in the 30s, a 3-gallon producer was a standard producer. One of the things that we did in those years, my mother would buy cows. And she would buy the low-producing one. She would buy a 3-gallon producer. I say low, about average producer. And my mother, first of all, would give her a little more feed. Feed her better. Second, she would give her a name. And third, she would treat that old cow lovingly and gently. And if one of us boys mistreated one of her cows, as we'd say down home, it is just too wet to plow. I mean, we were in bad trouble. Within 6 months after we got the cow, that cow was up to a 4-gallon-a-day producer. And invariably, within a year, that cow was producing close to 5 gallons a day, a dramatic increase in productivity. And mother would then sell that cow and get as much as $50 more than she had paid for it. Oftentimes, or always at least $25 more. 3 pounds of the best bacon sold for 27 cents. So when you start talking about another $25 or $50, you're talking about a substantial increase in the standard of living. You see, the way you treated that old cow does make a difference. And the way you treat people absolutely does also make a difference. We have a 3-day school called Born to Win. People literally come from all over the world. 3 or 4 years ago in one of the sessions, we had a beautiful black girl down from Chicago. She was a beauty queen. She looked like a queen. She acted like a queen. She talked like a queen. She was a queen. She had a graceful manner about her that was really fascinating. She had a voice that was totally feminine, and yet so strong that you could hear it for 200 people without any need of any kind of amplifying system. She was about 23, 24 years old, very successful businesswoman. She had, I believe at that time, 125 people working for her. Had you asked me, who in this class has got it all together? I mean, who is completely successful, who has the whole package. Which one of these people would you suggest or would you choose? Without any hesitation, I would have said, this is the one I would have chosen. On Saturday afternoon, as we were breaking up, she said, could I speak with you for a moment privately? And I said, well, of course. As we chatted, she started to cry. She said, you know, I believe she said 23 years old. In my lifetime, you're the first human being who's ever looked me right in the eye and said, you're important. I love you. God loves you. She said, that was why I came down here, is to hear those words from somebody who cared. She said, I'll never forget this experience. The great lesson I learned was this. If you will treat everybody like they're hurting, you'll be treating the vast majority of them in the proper way. Relationships are so important. My friend Fred Smith, who's truly one of the brightest men I know, wrote a beautiful book entitled You and Your Network. He said, in those experiences in life where we encounter people who are rude and mean and nasty and ugly to us, and that's going to happen in lots and lots of cases. He says, when those things happen, what you've got to understand is they're not trying to hurt you when they're mean and rude and nasty and ugly. He said, in 99% of the cases, they're that way because they are hurting. And if we can understand that, you say, whether we are a salesperson who's just failed to get the appointment or just failed to make the sale, and our prospect maybe invites us to leave as quickly as possible, or whether we're in a management employee situation and we feel that the manager has been too hard on us, or if we in a peer situation and our peer has been maybe too hard on us, it will be so helpful in building winning relationship if we can understand that they don't want to really hurt us, but they're hurting themselves, and they're defensive, and they'll lash out. If everybody was like my good friend Tom Hatfield, a course like this would not be even necessary. Tom is our insurance representative, been a good friend for quite a while. A couple of months ago, we had a nice storm here in Dallas, Texas. Some of you might remember it. Now, our home is centrally heated, as you might suspect. But everybody down here, and especially old Zig, just loves fireplaces. Oh, I love to watch that wood burn in that fireplace. And of all the times to run completely out of wood, old Zig ran completely out of wood. Well, knowing that Tom knows about everybody in town, I got on the telephone. I said, Tom, who do you know that I can call to bring me a load of wood? And he said, well, Zig, you know, I don't know right off the top of my hat, but he said, I'll scout around and see what I can find. About an hour later, my doorbell rang. I went to the front door, and there was Tom Hatfield. And he said, Zig, I have brought you some wood. He said, we got more than we need at the moment, and we're going to be getting another load next month anyhow. And he brought me enough wood that will last me 3 or 4 days there, or 5 or 6 days of steadily burning the wood. Now, you might say, well, Zig, you know, that's just a good salesman looking after his client. I'll acknowledge there might be a degree of truth in that. But I fervently believe that had I never bought a dime's worth of anything from Tom Hatfield, I would have still gotten that wood because he and I are friends. Now, what does that do to our relationship when you go a little out of your way to do something for someone else? I believe that's the key. You know, the Bible says it in a lot of different ways. Best human relations rule of all right there in the Bible. In the King James Version, it says, do unto others as ye would that they should do unto you. Which I read the Children's Bible, International Children's Bible. It is written at the 3rd grade, 9th month level, which is more along with what I understand. And this version simply says, treat others like you want them to treat you. Now, you know, that's just so very, very simple. There's another verse in the Bible that says, be ye kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving each other. So enormously important in our scheme of things if we do it that way, isn't it? There's another verse in there that says, go the extra mile. If somebody demands of you your cloak, give him your coat also. If they demand that you go 1 mile, go the second mile with them. So you can have everything in life you want if you'll just help enough other people get what they want. The bottom line that I keep getting to is, does it work? Now, let me remind you, number one, you're what you are and where you are because of what's gone into your mind. And you can change what you are. You can change where you are by changing what goes into your mind. Number two, I would remind you that life is tough. I don't care what you do, whether you're a household executive, a salesperson, a manager, a school teacher, a physician, a minister. I don't care what it is that you do. Life is tough. But when you're tough on yourself, life is infinitely easier on you. And the third thing I will say so many times is that you can have everything in life you want if you'll just help enough other people get what they want. What is a good relationship concept? I believe that Bear Bryant had one of the greatest that I've ever heard of. He was the second winningest football coach in history. He is second only to Eddie Robinson over at Grambling College. Coach Bryant had a basic philosophy. If things went bad, I mean on the team, if his team was blown out, if it went bad, he'd always say, well, you know, it's all my fault. I have seen when his team was just obliterated, I mean wiped out. The other team beat him 2, 3, 4 touchdowns. And always in the interview, Bryant would say, well, I guess you got to face it. They just simply out-coached me. The other coach did a better job of getting his team ready. If it is bad, I did it, was his concept. If it was kind of mediocre, he would say, well, you know, it was kind of a team effort there. Me and the team together, we just did a very, very mediocre job. But if it was a fantastic win, he would always say, I got to tell you, this is the greatest group of young men that I've ever had the privilege of coaching. They did it. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that will work. I don't care where you are. Losers are basically described in this little parable by Charles Allen in his book, The Miracle of Love. He said, a fisherman told him that when you're crabbing, when you're catching crabs, that you do not need to put a top on the basket you put the crabs in. All you got to do is have this open basket because, he said, when you put the second crab in there, anytime one of them tries to climb up, the other one will reach up and pull him down. Those are losers. Those are the people who are so insecure that they cannot really relate to somebody else being successful. They think in terms of somebody else being successful, that means they've got to be put down. They believe in the seesaw principle. The only way I'm going to go up is to put somebody else down. But if you'll notice, the seesaw is always up and down and up and down. And people who have that philosophy are going to be up and down, and mostly down. It's still true that the best exercise is to reach down and lift someone up. It's also true that when you go looking for friends, you're not likely to find them. But when you go out to be a friend, you'll find them everywhere. Because you see, what you send out does come back. I know you've heard the story. A little boy and his mother had a blow-up one morning, and in a fit of anger, as small children often do, he said to his mother, I hate you, I hate you. Then realizing what he had said and fearing for his future comfort, he made a mad dash out of the front door, and they lived out on the side of a hill. And when he got out there, he was still all frustrated and bent out of shape, and he started screaming, I hate you, I hate you. And then the echo came back, I hate you, I hate you. It frightened the little boy. He ran in, and he said, Mom, he said, there's a mean little boy out there in the valley who says he hates me. And his mother says, yes, but there's also another real nice little boy out there that loves you. You go out there and tell him that you love him. And so the little boy ran out and he said, I love you, I love you. And the echo came back, I love you, I love you. It is so true, simple but true, that what you send out comes back. Bottom line, does the concept work? Answer, yes, the concept works. Barry Tacker, down in Bay City, Texas, several years ago, was the disciplinarian at the school. They bought this basic idea that we're talking about here. They started teaching these concepts. Now, for those of you who are not Texans, your state might not have disciplinarians. But let me tell you, the disciplinarian is not the most popular member of the teaching staff. As a matter of fact, you're talking about instilling fear in the minds of the students. When the teacher said, go see the disciplinarian, I'll tell you, the students just froze because they knew they were in trouble. First day this took place, this young fellow walked in, and the teacher said to him, Mr. Tacker wants to see you. The youngster immediately became defensive. I didn't do anything, didn't do a thing. And the teacher said, well, Mr. Tacker wants to see you right now before class starts. With fear and trembling, the young man goes down to see him. And he walked in protesting, Mr. Tacker, didn't do a thing, didn't do a thing. And Mr. Tacker said, well, now that's not what I heard. I didn't do it, Mr. Tacker, I didn't do it. I'm telling you, I didn't do it. I'm innocent. And Mr. Tacker said, well, the story I got was this. This very morning, less than 2 blocks from here, you were seen helping an elderly lady across the street. Now, the question is, do you plead guilty or do you plead innocent? And enormously relieved, the young man said, I did it, Mr. Tacker, I did it. And Mr. Tacker says, does your mother have any idea what you're up to these days? And the young man said, well, I don't guess so. I never told her. And Mr. Tacker said, well, it's important that your mother knows. And I'm going to send this note home for her to sign. And I mean, you better sign it and bring it back. The youngster, of course, was elated. Hundreds of cases that year took place where they looked for the things they were doing right. And they sent word home to the parents. The teachers, the school administrators, the students, and the parents all drew closer together. Because, you see, they understood that they are working on the same project. It's the story of the little guy who was confronted by the three bullies, any one of whom could have obliterated him. And it looked like they were going to do exactly that. Smart little fella. He took a little stick. He drew a line there on the ground. And he backed up a few paces. He looked up at the biggest of the bullies. And he said, now you just step across that line. With a confident expression, the big bully stepped across the line. And the little guy said, now, we're both on the same side. I wonder how many marriages would be better if the husbands and the wives clearly understood we're both on the same side. I wonder how many school systems would be better if parents and students and teachers and administrators all understood they're on the same side. I wonder how much more productive we would be in our business environment if labor and management, employer, employee, both clearly understood that they are on the same side. That unless there is productivity, unless there is profit, then everybody there is going to be the loser. One of the most amazing stories I think I have ever heard is this one. Several years ago in Indianapolis, Indiana, a fellow named Charlie Pfluger came to one of our seminars for educators. He bought into this concept, this idea of becoming a good finder. He was the assistant principal at an inner city school in Indianapolis, and this was to be their last year. Now, I don't know how much you know about the inner city school and the attitude which takes place anytime a school is going to be closing down. When that school gets ready to close, everybody, you know, closes it about a year early. Why bother to take care of anything? You know, this is the last year. We might as well just, you know, let it go. Well, Charlie Pfluger went in with this basic idea. He initiated a little program. And what he started doing was giving a little disc. What he did was he simply took a silver dollar, drew a line or drew a circle around it, and wrote the words, I can, on it. And he initiated a program. And every time a youngster was voluntarily seen picking up a piece of paper, one of the teachers would give him an I can. If he were seen erasing the blackboard without being told, they gave him an I can. If he turned in something which had been lost, then they gave him an I can. If he voluntarily welcomed a new student to school, they gave him an I can. Now, when they received 100 I cans, then each student was given a winner's t-shirt, an I can t-shirt. Had 592 kids in the school, and 587 of them won I Can t-shirts. Charlie said it got to be the badge of honor. It was a status symbol to have your I Can t-shirt on. He said it even got ridiculous. You'd see a piece of paper blowing across the schoolyard. There'd be five kids out there running that piece of paper down. He said they helped old ladies across the street that didn't want to cross the street. And when a youngster would, you know, come to school and they're just enrolled, about 300 of the kids would individually shake hands with them and welcome them to the school. They never had anything that was lost that was not found. You might say, yeah, but 587 t-shirts, isn't that rather expensive? Yeah. Until you understand that there was not one single act of vandalism the whole year. Not a single drug arrest. Not a single drug bust. And teachers and parents and students and administrators came together more than they'd ever come together in that school. Now, folks, I'm talking about a relationships approach which will work. Everybody becomes the winner. Now, you got to understand that When we say you can have everything in life you want, if you'll just help enough other people get what they want, we're talking about a philosophy, not a tactic. I love the story of the obscure college professor who had a wife whom he loved very much. His wife was hard of hearing. He went to work in his laboratories to develop a hearing aid so that he could communicate more easily and more effectively with his wife. Now, history tells us that he never did invent a hearing aid. But other than that, history has been unusually kind to Alexander Graham Bell. Because while he was working on the hearing aid, doing a humanitarian thing because he loved his wife, he discovered the telephone procedures and techniques. Now, a little known fact is that several years earlier, a German inventor named Wilhelm Reis had actually discovered a process for sending sound over the wires. And had he moved two of the electrodes 1/1000th of an inch so that they touched, he would have been the inventor of the telephone. He would have been the one who discovered the method of sending voice over wire. Now, I have no idea what Reese's motivation was or what his motives were. But I do know what the motivation of Alexander Graham Bell was. And it's just another way of saying that the good guys and gals are other people oriented. They really do buy the concept of being good finders. People who build winning relationships say and do things to and for others. Now, I'm going to make a profound statement. I always tell my audiences when I'm about to make profound statements. As I said earlier, I do that because an incredibly high percentage of my audiences do not recognize my profound statements as being profound if I don't tell them in advance, and I just don't want you to miss this. I'm not the one who said it. Dr. Shal Sinha said that gossips and backbiters destroy themselves. Use a negative word on someone else and you feel some influence of that poison yourself. Make it a habit. Use it on lots and lots of people, and all of that poison accumulates, and it absolutely can be devastating. It's more than just a cliche that the best thing to do behind a man's back is to pat it. And easily the best way to remove a chip from somebody else's shoulder is to let him take a bow. Remember that you treat people like you see them. And those people who look down on others are generally living on a bluff. Oh, when we think about it, how true it is. I'll never forget one eye-opening experience that I had a number of years ago. A friend of mine, David Smith, invited me to be a substitute MC at the Elks Club Charity Ball. He said, "Zig, you know, I don't know." As a matter of fact, he called me Mr. Ziegler. He said, "I don't know if you've ever been to an Elks Club dance and banquet and all, but," he said, "it's quite an occasion. I've invited this politician to be there, but you know how some of these politicians are." And he said, "I'd just like for you to be there as the backup MC. Well, I'd always wanted to be a backup MC at an Elks Club charity ball. So I said, "Okay, Mr. Smith, we'll go. My wife and I'll be there." We got there and we were eating with David and his wife, and they got up and they started dancing. And before we started, we watched him a few minutes. And I was in absolute awe. I could not believe what I was seeing. He was 66 years old, and he was a ballroom dancer, one of the most graceful men I think I've ever seen. It was a magnificent experience. I sat there. As a matter of fact, the redhead and I never really danced that evening. We preferred to watch them. First time he came back, I said, "Mr. Smith, I'm in awe. I didn't know you could do that." He was somewhat embarrassed. He said, "Well," he said, "to tell you the truth, for a number of years I've been teaching ballroom dancing." Now, the David Smith I'm talking about was our yard man. One of the hardest working men I've ever seen in my life. At age 17, he had had to drop out of high school to support his family. At age 22, he went back to high school, got his diploma from high school at age 25. He had put his daughters through college because he had started as a yard man, but then he got into the landscaping and the other things. Now, the message, the eye-opener that I'm trying to communicate is this. We never judge a book by its cover. We should not. Mr. Smith had been our yard man for about 3 years. I'm embarrassed to say I knew absolutely nothing about him until that night, except that he was a hard worker who did a beautiful job. In hot August days, that man would get out there, and it would kill me, I guarantee you, in 30 minutes to follow him around. But he had taken that station, the only job he could really get, but he didn't stop at just cutting the grass and doing the edging. He studied and learned how to be a landscaper, and as a result, made a beautiful living because of it. One of the most fascinating stories about this concept was told to me one morning over on Carpenter Freeway by a lady who many of you know. Her name is Mary Kay Ash. I had spoken to her group that morning, and she didn't know I was going to come in. So toward the end of the talk, she walked in and sat there listening for a few minutes. And when it was over, she invited me to come in and talk with her about some future activity. She started telling me about her start. During the Depression, she was a Stanley dealer. She was a widow with small children down in Houston. She was selling Stanley brushes, and she had been averaging $7 a party in sales, and the gift she gave to the hostess cost her $5. Not exactly a money-making endeavor. Then she heard about the national convention that is going to be held right here in Dallas, Texas. She borrowed the $12, which was necessary for the transportation and the 3 nights in the hotel for the convention. I said it was during the Depression. Mary Kay's friends thought she was absolutely crazy to waste that $12 because what she needed to do was really look for a job so she could support her family. But she was determined to come. During the 3 days, Mary Kay camped on the doorstep of everyone who was extremely productive. When eating time came, the $12 did not include the meals, she always made an excuse, went to her room because she had brought cheese and crackers. And for 3 days, that's what she had to eat. On the night of the final banquet, where they honored the Queen of Sales, Mary Kay said there was a gorgeous brunette, tall and striking, whom she had been talking with all week, whom she had asked hundreds of questions, whom she had persuaded to put on a mock party so she could watch how she was doing it because she was the best in the country. That night, during the banquet awards, Mr. Stanley Beveridge, the president of the company, was there. And every lady there would walk down the aisle. Mr. Beveridge would shake hands with them. Now, Mary Kay said she was somewhere about in the middle of the pack when she walked past. And I'm certain she said there were a lot of people who said exactly the same thing I was going to say. But I stood in front of him that night and I said, Mr. Beveridge, you don't know who I am tonight. But next year, this time, you will. Because I'm going to be the Queen of Sales. Now, he could have said, sure, young lady, sure, I know you are. He'd probably been told that by 20 ladies before Mary Kay got there. He could have sloughed it off, you know, as being somebody enthusiastic and they're going to make all these big promises and then disappear forever. But Mary Kay said the most meaningful moment of her career took place right there when Mr. Beveridge quietly, calmly, deliberately looked her right in the eye. And she said, for what seemed like forever, he said nothing. And then he said, you know, young lady, somehow or other, I believe you will. Mary Kay said it had a profound impact on her life. Next year, she was the Queen of Sales. A lot of people have gone a lot further than they thought they could because somebody else thought they could. We need to be an encourager. Gordon MacDonald says it well. My wife Gail and I try to treat the people around us in terms of potential rather than just performance. You think about it, it makes an awful lot of sense. Sometimes one act, one simple act, can affect literally millions and millions of people. Many years ago, just outside of Boston, there was a mental institution which was way ahead of its time. They had gained a substantial reputation for their ability to deal with those people who had mental problems. But even in that enlightened institution, they had a dungeon. And in the dungeon, they would put the hopelessly insane, those for whom nothing could be done. And so they had this little girl there. She was known simply as Little Annie. Little Annie, one day, was just as sane and reasonable as anybody. And the next day, she would be a vicious little animal. I mean, almost attacking anybody who came within range. There was an elderly nurse who was at the hospital, and she was getting ready for retirement. And she started, as a matter of habit, each day, going down to the dungeon and at lunchtime, sitting next to the cage where little Annie was kept. Sometimes she would carry on a little conversation, sometimes she would say nothing, but always she was there. One day, she brought down some brownies. And as she got ready to leave, she just put the brownies on a little tray inside of little Annie's cage. When she went back the next day, the brownies were gone. Once each week thereafter, she started bringing the brownies down. A few weeks later, the doctors noticed that little Annie was making remarkable progress. They decided maybe something could be done. They moved her upstairs. And over a period of years, her emotional stability, her mental health was completely restored. And they came to her one day and said, Little Annie, you may go home if you'd like. She said, no, this place has meant so much to me. I would like to stay here a few years longer, and I would like to be able to make a contribution to some others as my way of saying thank you to this institution for what it has done for me. Many, many years later, when Queen Victoria of England was pinning England's highest award on Helen Keller, they asked her, Queen Victoria did, Helen, to whom or to what do you owe your remarkable progress, your remarkable accomplishments in life? The fact that you've favorably influenced and had an impact on literally millions and millions of lives. Helen Keller said, had it not been for Anne Sullivan, little Annie, nobody would have ever known who Helen Keller was. You never know when you throw the pebble in the stream or the lake how far the circles are going to go. You never know how far it's going to go when we have a word of encouragement for somebody else, because the way you treat people can make a dramatic difference in the way they handle life. Right down here in Italy, Texas, there was a little girl. Her name was Linda Isaacs. Linda is a black girl. She was a dwarf. They had diagnosed her when she was about 4 years old as being learning disabled. She could not learn things, but when she was 6 years old, they put her in the first grade. There was no other place to put her. Her mother and everybody said to the teachers, now don't worry about trying to teach Linda anything. She can't learn. But she's a pleasant little girl. Her classmates will adopt her, make her the class mascot. She'll be called Shorty, but she'll be very popular and everybody will just love her. Well, that's exactly what happened. They didn't try to teach her anything, so she didn't learn anything. End of the first year, they decided that instead of holding her back, they would move her on up to the second grade. Because otherwise, she's not going to learn anything in either grade, and they didn't want to have to make a new set of friends for every year. Linda Isaacs graduated from high school functioning at the first grade level.